opinions expressed on the following program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Absolute Broadcasting, its staff, or advertisers.
It's time for Israel is Real. Two Israelis putting a human face on all things Israel. Rahel and Sonia focus on life in modern 21st century Israel, telling the stories of ordinary people living in, loving, and in support of an extraordinary land. Israel is Real is a community-supported program featuring interviews with local, national, and international celebrities, personal life stories, and call-ins. Learn a new Hebrew word every week. Israel is Real. Every Friday on 1590 WSMN. Nashua's News and Talk. And now, your hosts, Rahel and Sonia.
Hi, we're Rahel and
Sonia.
And this is Israel is Real. Boker Tov lekol ha-mazinim.
Tzoraim tovim b'Yisrael.
From WSMN 1590, Nashua's News and Talk. We're a community-supported program, and as usual, we depend on your support to stay on the air. We'd like to extend our thanks to all of those who love and support our efforts on behalf of spreading the good news about Israel. So, as always, we are chronically fundraising, and we're running out of money, I must say. So, if you want to keep us going, please do contribute. You can find out information on our website at www.israelisreal.weebly.com. That's israelisreal.weebly.com. And you can email us at israelisreal1590@gmail.com. That's israelisreal1590@gmail.com. We are ever grateful for those who continue to sponsor us, and one of our sponsors is Vision.
Did you know that Vision is an organization that educates our community about the little country of Israel? Did you know Israel is approximately about the size of New Jersey? To receive Vision's emails alert and be informed about Vision's educational activities and opportunities, please visit Vision's website at www.newhampshireforisrael.org. That's www.nh4israel.org.
I'd like to also mention that our music is brought to you by Rahel, and that's me. And you can find more music by Rahel at www.rahelmusic.com. That's www.rahelmusic.com. Boker Tov, Sonia.
Boker Tov.
We would like to introduce our listeners to another Hebrew word this week, which is
tzilum. Tzilum means photography. So if it was so simple, why shall I speak about this? Because the exact meaning and connotation of the word, it's coming from Betzelem. And Betzelem is kind of an image. But how is the relate to the shadow? Because it's a tzel. So, and what is the root that they share? And
I love hearing about roots.
Yes. And what are the connotation to that root? And is the God implication, metaphorically speaking, in a light source and we human that we are project slides? We know that Tzelem has the connotation of minting the king's image on a coin, which is why Tzilum is the modern Hebrew for photography.
Minting would have been maybe an original kind of photography.
This is what they have, yes. You know, imprint certain face in a coin. But when God made man, Betzelel Elohim, which is in God's image, it was in God's spiritual and moral image and not in a physical sense. From the other side, shadow, which means tzel, and image, betzelem, are closely related nouns and share the same three Hebrew roots letter, which are tzelem, tzadik lamed mem. It lends itself to image, which is tzelem, and tutsilum, both photography and snapshot, and tsel, which is shadow. And any image on a coin is a tselem, whether it's a king herd or a Lincoln memorial. And how is this related to our show?
Well, we have today a really, really special guest. And her name is Miss Diane Covert, who is actually a photographer and also the creator and the artist of a project called Inside Terrorism, the X-Ray Project. And we're extremely excited that Diane is here with us today. A little bit about the X-Ray Project. It's a photography exhibit which uses actual X-rays and CT scans from the two largest hospitals in Jerusalem to explore the most important social issue of our time, which is the effects of terrorism on the civilian population. And this project also serves as a new innovative medium to advocate for Israel and against terrorism all over the world. Boker Tov, Diane.
Boker Tov, and thank you for that wonderful introduction about Tzilum. I didn't know this. That's great.
We try and connect our Hebrew words to the subject of the day, so it's pretty exciting. As I said, we're really happy to have you here today. If you don't mind, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about who you are, the field, the area, or art form, the form of art that you are actually working with, and something we've talked about, the word tzilum, photography, and maybe you could tell us a little bit about the history.
Okay, well, I'm Diane Covert. I am an artist, and most of my career I've worked in photography, whether it would be commercially or just as a documentary photographer. This is a pure documentary project. And by that I mean, usually with a documentary approach, there's a point of view expressed because the artist cannot help it. It's where you stand, you control the light, you somehow communicate your opinion. In this case, we took images that were made in order to save human lives, because these are images of people who were severely damaged in terror attacks, and they were brought to the hospital, and a physician ordered up the X-ray of the CT scan. And the purpose of this show, it's manifold, but it is a very, very clean documentary installation of what happens to victims in a modern terror attack without commentary, in a way, by the artist who put it together, because I took the material directly from the hospitals. The other thing is that you're looking inside terrorism. That's why I called it Inside Terrorism. So these are portraits and figure studies of terrorism. And instead of using the light that's bouncing off the object to make a photograph as you probably think about it, we use light that goes through the object, and we actually see what goes on inside terrorism directly.
This is really a first kind of exhibition of its kind, wouldn't you say?
I think so. I don't know for sure, but I think so.
Yeah. I'm wondering what inspired you, number one, to get into photography, and then number two, to go with this kind of a project.
When I was a student at art school, I took a history of photography course, just randomly chose to take it, and it was just fascinating, and I just became so excited by the potential of the medium, because you can compress so much information into such a, you know, just a few nowadays pixels, or a very, very tiny little bit of silver can communicate so much. And if you know art history well, you realize that you can comment all the way back in time and all the way forward to today in this very, very compressed way. Like in the X-Ray Project, we're able to talk about the history of making portraits and figure studies and how we do it today and why we would change it, but we can also talk about the ethics around it. So from a purely art basis, that's what excited me. Now, from a personal basis, the reason that I did it was because I heard a single interview, or not interview, I guess a conversation on National Public Radio in 2002, shortly after a woman, I think her name is Wafa Idris, blew herself up on the streets of Jerusalem. Wow. And
she was the first suicide woman bombed.
Yes, and she was treated by NPR and also by the world in general as a feminist icon, a feminist hero. And the piece that I heard equated her actions with women participating in the political system. So as a woman with, you know, children and of a certain age, I knew that this was not feminism, and this was infuriating. And I spent a lot of time trying to find out who her victim was or the victims were. The one person that she murdered was an elderly man named Pincus Tocatli. He was about 83 years old. He had 13 children and grandchildren, 13 grandchildren and great-grandchildren. In his retirement, he was an artist. He loved painting. I mean, so I felt kinship immediately. His family had been in Jerusalem for many, 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 many generations. He fought the British, I think. And so I wanted his name mentioned, and I wanted his suffering remembered. And I tried to contact NPR, and I did not receive any answer. And then it just occurred to me that somehow we have to explain to the world exactly what terrorism is. This is not a joke, and it's not feminism. It's not political action.
And these are not heroes.
And this is not courage.
Right. So I, and this happens all over the world, you have to realize. It's easy for me and probably most of your listeners to think about it in an Israeli context, but it goes on in southern Thailand, it goes on in India, it goes on almost, I think, every single continent with the exception of Antarctica has had problems with this. So,
And it's now becoming a little bit more popular, unfortunately, on American soil.
Yeah, it's a technique, and it's a successful technique. What the people who use this technique use it for works. The way for us to stop it is to see to it that it's unsuccessful, that it doesn't work, that it causes loss of funding, loss of publicity, and loss of respect. But every time in funding and respect and publicity increase, they see this as a useful technique.
Well, what I really appreciate, we're going to cut for a break soon, but what I really appreciate is what inspired you to really search for the victim, to put a name on this anonymous person that gets blown up and killed that most people don't think about.
I spent 3 hours on the internet trying to figure out, after I heard that story back in February of 2002, who was the victim. It took me 3 hours. And I thought, this is ridiculous. This is a human being who was murdered. Why is he being erased? Right. And I have this, photographers in general, I think, try to preserve things, and documentary photographers try to preserve things and protect things. So I wanted not to allow him to be erased, and then, by extension, the rest of them.
And this is the courage that you have in going forth with this project. We're speaking with Diane Covert of the X-Ray Project, Inside Terrorism. This is WSMN 1590, and we're Israel is real. We'll be back.
WSMN
and WSMNradio.com. Do you need affordable housing? Are you or someone you know at least 62 years of age? Living in Nashua? Working in Nashua? Or have you been hired to work in Nashua? Are you in need of public housing assistance? Nashua Housing Authority is looking for elderly applicants for its efficiency, one-bedroom, two-bedroom, and fully accessible local waiting lists. Our current waiting lists are very short. If you are interested and would like to fill out an application, stop by our main office on 40 East Pearl Street in Nashua, New Hampshire, or call us at 603-883-5661. Applicants must be income eligible. The following income limits apply. One person living in the household can make up to $44,800 annually. Two persons living in the household can make up to $51,200 annually. Three persons living in the household can make up to $57,600 annually. Four persons living in the household can make up to $64,000 annually. So if you need affordable housing and meet the previously mentioned criteria, stop by or call 603-883-5661 today. Nashua Housing is an equal housing opportunity and offers free translation services.
The Telegraph, keeping you connected to your community for pennies a day. When news breaks, The Telegraph is there. When the community needs a watchdog, The Telegraph is there. When it's time to celebrate the accomplishments of our young athletes and scholars, The Telegraph is there. The Telegraph has been recognized for 7 years in a row as the best small daily newspaper. Sunshine Week kicks off on Sunday, March 14, and continues throughout the week as The Telegraph joins newspapers from across the nation in shining the spotlight on right-to-know issues.
Blurriness, wavy lines, blind spot, these are all symptoms of a chronic condition called wet age-related macular degeneration, or wet AMD. It can develop quickly, and it's a leading cause of blindness in people 60 and older. March is AMD Awareness Month. Visit AMDAwareness.org to learn about your risk factors and how a retina specialist can help. Knowing the symptoms may save your sight. Learn what you need to know at AMDAwareness.org today. This message was brought to you by the American Society of Retina Specialists and Genentech.
Got a question. What's the worst thing about buying a used car? Could it be the uncertainty of not knowing what you're really getting? Bingo! Now I have an answer. Honda Certified Used Cars. They're well-maintained late-model Hondas. Each undergoes a 150-point inspection, then is backed with an incredible 7-year, 100,000-mile powertrain warranty and a 12-month, 12,000-mile limited non-powertrain warranty. Did the comfort level just go up in here? Thought so. Honda Certified Used Cars. It's the next best thing to new.
See dealer for limited warranty details.
Catch the 12-Step Radio Show, Steppin' Out, Sunday mornings at 6 on 1590 WSMN.
Oh, really?
I don't know what it was, just the way he asked the questions.
We're back on WSMN 1590, Nashua's News and Talk, with Israel is Real. We're two Israelis putting a human face on all things Israel. Don't forget that we are, as always, dependent on your support to keep us going. You can find us at www.israelisreal.weebly.com, israelisreal.weebly.com. And you can email us at israelisreal1590@gmail.com, israelisreal1590@gmail.com. And we'd like to mention another sponsor who we are eternally grateful for, who offers continuing support and can be very, very helpful for those who are in patent. Countries depend for much of their success and security on their intellectual prowess and advanced technology. Many companies from here and abroad depend on the patent attorneys at Vern Main and Associates to obtain U.S. or global patent protection for their new ideas. Vern Main and Associates is an intellectual property law firm right here in Nashua. For professional legal counseling on all intellectual property matters, contact the legal specialists at Vern Main and Associates at their offices on 100 Main Street right here in Nashua, or on the web at vernmaine.com, www.vernmaine.com. That's vernmaine.com. And we're back speaking with Diane Covert about her exhibition called Inside Terrorism, The X-Ray Project. Shalom again,
shalom.
Diane.
I am struck by your ability to put together an art exhibit and a human scream. and they are both simultaneously with the same intensity. And tell us how you came to this idea to take X-rays and to make from a medical exhibit something which will speak for everyone.
Well, that's a really interesting question. First of all, X-rays are photographs, and I'm a photographer. They're using a different wavelength, and that wavelength of light allows you to go inside of a body. So in modern art circles, postmodern, we talk a little bit differently about the ideas that were developed over the centuries in Western art. Like, what is the meaning of the inside of the person? If you look at a portrait, what's going on inside the individual? So we've made it more concrete. This is inside. Inside is nails, it's watches, it's hex nuts, it's bolts. This is portraiture. The other function of using these medical images or another function is that they are not bloody and they are less grotesque and less frightening. So it allows people to approach it as closely or to keep as much distance as they want, and each person can learn as much as they can tolerate. A medical student can get very, very close and really look at all the damage and understand the reconstruction that would be necessary, or a physician can explain this to their students. But if you, say, want to become a kindergarten teacher, maybe it's enough for you to know that there's this level of evil in the world, that people are willing to pack bombs with common objects that you could buy at a Home Depot in order to murder other people. And maybe you can't get that close to it, but you need it. Humanizes you to understand it, and it builds empathy with the victims without completely traumatizing the viewer.
I think a key word is human, in one respect, that also I didn't think of it before, but by showing just the X-ray, you also preserve and maintain the dignity of the victim. By, you know, oftentimes we see on the news reports, you know, the victim lying there in a bloody mess.
Right.
That's not very dignified for the victim. That's how, you know, your last memory of the victim. And this sort of, in a way, ironically, kind of preserves the victim's dignity as well.
And we've eliminated, by doing this, race, religion, ethnicity, and income level. You can know age in some of the X-rays. If you're trained or if I've labeled them, you can know the age, but that's about it, or the gender, and that's about it.
What have been some of the reactions? Are you aware of just generally people who have seen it? What are their reactions and responses? Maybe more professional people, what kind of responses do they have?
Well, I had, on the professional end of things, I had the chief of radiology at Stanford School of Medicine tell me that these were the worst and most appalling injuries he had ever seen in his career, and that Stanford is tied to a trauma center. And he said that the force involved in the multiple breakage and the explosions was just shocking to him. He could tell by looking at in fact, there was one image particularly of a very badly broken up hand that he said is life-threatening because of what it's doing to an artery. And he said that particular image was the worst thing he had ever seen. But on the other hand, I've had people who are just ordinary people, non-medical professionals, walk in and just burst into tears because they can recognize, you know, this is an arm that's gone, it's missing, where is it? Or just the amount of pain. I had one student tell me that he had been in a skiing accident and it was just, his leg was broken, it was terrible pain, but nothing like he'd seen the X-ray, nothing like this one particular image I have of a very badly smashed up leg. And then unfortunately, I've had some hostility from people who feel that we shouldn't show these victims.
Why?
Because, well, I actually had one student tell me that he was glad that those people were suffering that much.
Why?
Oh, dear.
Because they are Israeli, and he believed that they were all Israeli Jews. And I said, guess what? You know what? There's a lot of Palestinians, and there are a lot of Christians in this sample.
Exactly.
But I have to say, he is the far and away the minority. The overwhelming majority of people learn and appreciate something about the horrors of terrorism as a technique and understand that it is separate from any political dispute. It's just a technique. In other words, if you get an infection and it's the same infection, it's going to be treated the same here in Nashua that it would be treated in Boston. Right. It's just a technique. They know what to do about it. This is a technique to create chaos and destruction. And by the way, the
intimidation.
Intimidation.
To put you in a place that you are unable to think straight, rational, with logic.
And something that every X-ray in the installation does, I brought one to show you, just a reprint of one of the images. And people can see this on the website. But
we can show it on the webcam. Are you seeing it now?
Seeing.
Can you see it?
It should be okay.
Yeah. What we're seeing, if you can't see it on the webcam, Diane, could you explain what we're seeing?
It's a portrait. It's a neck and a chin and the base of the head, side view profile of an individual that has a nail lodged in his or her neck. But what that image shows, and every image in the installation does this, they all do this, is the range of what human beings are capable of. Because on the one end, you have this common utilitarian object, which is a nail that we use for constructive purposes, like right. to build buildings, right? Mm-hmm. Or to repair broken things, packed into a bomb with the intent to kill. And at the other end, you have the response team that is trying to help this individual. I understand that this is a life-threatening injury, but the response team is the ambulance drivers, the nurses, the doctors, the X-ray technologists, the psychologists that are trying to help the family, and the surgeon, obviously, the people who are funding the medical schools. And this is worldwide. This is how civilization mm-hmm. responds to anarchy. So the compression, this is what I love about photography, the compression of all of that, how many words does it take to really flesh out that idea into these little images. Do you understand?
Right. And they always say, you know, a picture is worth 1,000 words. And if our listeners would go to your website, which is
x-ray.com. You have to put the dash.
x-ray.com. Uh-huh. You've got some visuals there as well. And when you see them, I mean, it's heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking. And it does speak much more than words, that's for sure.
Who are your so-called clients that you are showing them the exhibit?
The installation has been seen in roughly 30 universities, medical schools, some hospitals, some galleries, medical association meetings, radiology meetings. Undergrad, grad students, some to art students, some to policy people, criminal justice people, nursing groups, just different types of educational settings, plus galleries and hospitals.
It's only in United States?
So far, I have been contacted by the Israelis, by Australia, by Canada, by Great Britain, and Portugal. But the trouble is the expense of shipping it there. It's large. These are life-size images, and my husband is the engineer, Steve Covert. He's put together this installation. They're internally lit, so you see them as X-rays, and that means that there's a certain amount of bulk in communicating this stuff. I have a smaller installation that would be easier to travel if somebody was interested in another country. Or we could just do a website thing. But the full installation is, you know, 6 large crates.
And to see it in real life is obviously much more effective and has a greater impact.
Right.
I would imagine.
Because you can control the time, the distance, and the amount of detail that you take in a way that you can't do on the web. You can't see it as clearly on the website, and you can't back away from it the same way either.
And also you can't simply click to another thing that'll make you feel better.
Right. Right.
Yeah. So the value of this exhibition, number one, is twofold. It's as an art exhibition and also an expose of what's going on in real life. How do you assess that, sort of?
I just think that most art projects and certainly most photography projects that have ever been done have a broader appeal than simply this is a beautiful flower or something. That every time somebody makes something, they're speaking to their own time. I mean, when Picasso painted Guernica, he was speaking to his own time and to his own concerns. But it was also informed by medieval art and Renaissance art. And if you look at it, you see those qualities.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, my work, I looked at a lot of medieval art because X-rays have this interesting fact. They don't show three-dimensional projections. Everything's very flat, and that's also true pre-Renaissance. That's how people created. So I just think that there's always many different facets of any big project. And, you know, if someone works for a long time on something, it gets richer, I guess, over time. Yeah.
Something that we have to take a break in another minute, but something that keeps going through my head, what we were talking about previously, where the world seems to have more sympathy towards the suicide bomber than to the victim. And I don't know, for some reason, that's just, it seems like that's so backwards. And your work is just extremely important, that so many people should be able to see this and should see it in order to see the reality of this phenomenon that we are living with today. And, you know, not just as a documentary, but we are living with this today, and many people, I think, don't realize that.
Yeah, it's possibly more titillating at some level to know that Muhammad Atta was an architect, or his father was an architect or something, and he grew up in the middle class in Cairo, and yada, yada, yada. But it's, I think, more important to us as human beings to understand the nearly 3,000 people that he killed in New York and in D.C. and in Pennsylvania.
He was an architect, maybe, but for killing.
Yeah, I guess.
And, you know, the world worries about humanity and the human rights and things like that. And I just wonder, where is all of that? If you can see what this is producing.
It can make a person a little bit cynical, can't it?
Yeah. We're going to take a break again. We're speaking with Diane Covert of Inside Terrorism, the X-Ray Project. And this is WSMN 1590, and where Israel is real.
Simchu vad Hashem v'gilu tzadikim v'harninu kol kol yishrei lev.
1590 WSMN
and WSMNradio.com.
Do you need affordable housing? Are you or someone you know at least 62 years of age, living in Nashua, working in Nashua, or have you been hired to work in Nashua? Are you in need of public housing assistance? Nashua Housing Authority is looking for elderly applicants for its efficiency, one-bedroom, two-bedroom, and fully accessible local waiting lists. Our current waiting lists are very short. If you are interested and would like to fill out an application, stop by our main office on 40 East Pearl Street in Nashua, New Hampshire, or call us at 603-883-5661. Applicants must be income eligible. The following income limits apply. One person living in the household can make up to $44,800 annually. Two persons living in the household can make up to $51,200 annually. Three persons living in the household can make up to $57,600 annually. Four persons living in the household can make up to $64,000 annually. So if you need affordable housing and meet the previously mentioned criteria, stop by or call 603-883-5661 today. Nashua Housing is an equal housing opportunity and offers free translation services.
Laura, that was an amazing meal. The guys really went to town on that leg of lamb.
Yeah, thanks, Amy. I'm glad everyone enjoyed it.
It's hard to believe how much you and Jim have done with the house in such a short amount of time. It's just gorgeous.
Yeah, we love it too. And the kids are really thriving in school here. But...
But what? Something's wrong. I know you too well.
Jim's company is cutting his salary, and he may even get laid off. He doesn't think we'll be able to afford the mortgage.
Oh, Laura. You know what? My cousin Susan and her husband were in a similar situation, but they got some terrific advice for free from a housing counselor from the NFCC, the National Foundation for Credit Counseling. You need to be careful who you can trust these days with so many so-called mortgage consultants out there. The NFCC is nonprofit and has been around for more than 50 years.
If you think you're in danger of foreclosure, call the NFCC today at 866-687-6322 or visit mortgagehelpnow.org. That's mortgagehelpnow.org, a public service from the NFCC.
Thanks for supporting the local businesses you hear advertised and highlighted every day on 1590 WSMN.
We're back on WSMN 1590, Nashua's News and Talk, with Israel is Real. Again, we're two Israelis putting a human face on all things Israel. I'm Rachel and...
Sonia.
And our music is brought to you by Rachel
nice.
Today. And it can be found at www.rachelmusic.com, rahelmusic.com. Another wonderful sponsor of ours is, again, Vision.
Did you know that the Vision is an organization that educates our community about the little country of Israel and informs you of how its technical advance personally benefit you? Did you know that Israeli scientists have developed a way to use white blood cells from healthy donor blood to stimulate the patient's own body to complete the healing process, especially for complication following surgery? To receive Vision's emails alert and be informed about Vision's educational activities and opportunities, please visit Vision's website at www.newhampshireforisrael.org. That's www.nh4israel.org.
And we're speaking again today with Ms. Diane Covert, and we're very excited about her project called Inside Terrorism, the X-Ray Project. Diane is a photographer and has brought forth a very, very important exhibition to the world, and we hope that it will be worldwide, seen worldwide, and we're trying to help that out for you. We were talking before a little bit about where, well, we didn't ask this yet, but where does this phenomenon come from? You know, we know that we hear that there are state-sponsored kind of terrorism, things like that. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I'm not a policy person. I'm an artist, but I also have a background in social work. and I can tell you that desperation does not account for the tremendous rise in terrorism we've seen, because there's been research done prior to this big upswing, which began roughly around September 11th. And that research came out of the University of Chicago, and it indicated that there was about 9 suicide-type terror attacks per year, 9 individuals per year, and now the numbers are in the hundreds. So it's not a desperation thing, and that kind of leaves us with policy. It seems that terrorism works, and at some level, this is my hypothesis, every time there is a major terror attack, and then there are summer camps named after terrorists, or human liberation conferences named after people who blew themselves
courses.
Up. Courses, whatever. the legitimacy and the prestige, and then the money follows, is handed to these terrorist organizations, and they're familiar with each other. I mean, in the 1980s, I think they used to train together, the European groups and the various Palestinian groups in the Bekaa Valley. And now I'm sure it can all be done by computers or whatever. But they're not dumb people. They're not. The leadership is not hopelessly depressed with no other idea and feeling the need to commit suicide out of despair. These are decisions that were made at a very high level to encourage young people to give up their lives in their minds for their country, for a good cause, and actually to commit suicide. If you think about it in terms of child abuse, and I know that most of our listeners, your listeners, are furious with the terrorists. But if you just consider the idea of a 16-year-old who wants to be popular, wants to be a hero, wants to be regarded by his peers forever and ever, so he puts on that suicide vest. They don't understand that life ends and ends completely. At that age, they still have fantasies that, you know, that they'll be a hero forever in the afterlife and all this. So it's child abuse, in part. It's a terrible thing.
They're not able, really, to understand the concept of death, and that it's
the
final.
The permanence, yes.
Right.
Yes.
You had mentioned that an interview about a Hamas terrorist.
Yeah. If anybody is interested, the September 11th, 2006, New Yorker magazine, which I have saved because it's so fascinating, did an interview with a Hamas terrorist and his then 14-year-old son. And this kid was, to read the article, a normal kid. He had friends. He had soccer. He wanted to be an artist when he grew up, which endeared him to me. He loved to draw. And his dad said to him, in front of the New York Times interviewer, "All of this is good, but what I really want you to be is a martyr for the cause." And then that kid gets up from the couch, goes into his bedroom, comes back into the living room, pulls out his martyr picture, shows this photograph of himself with guns or whatever, and says, "Our high school has the best pictures. We're the best." Now, if you think about this in terms of child development, you'll understand what I mean by a form
child
of
abuse.
Child abuse. Yes, because, you know, usually it's like we're the best soccer team, or in the United States football team, or whatever. We won this or we won that. It takes adult supervision to organize children, not even young adults, to think this way and to plan this way. And because of their need to be part of a group, to be popular and to be looked up to as heroes, a certain percentage of them will forfeit their life for this. It's terrible. It's a terrible, terrible tragedy. And I know it's a hard sell for a lot of your listeners, but that is another aspect of it. Very often they're people who have even developmental delays. They cannot possibly understand what they're doing. And they're just told to go stand somewhere and some handler activates the bomb. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't know.
And besides, if desperation was motivate suicidal murdered after the Holocaust. We should have it in Germany by 10 and thousand and hundreds of thousands of survivors.
Mm-hmm.
And not this is the respond to a desperation.
Right. That's a bogus description of what's going on, and it hasn't held water, nor has the poverty hypothesis. I mean, Muhammad Atta blew that one away by being middle class.
Osama bin Laden.
Yeah. He's wealthy.
We see more and more that many of the terrorists are from, you know, are educated and well off. So it's certainly not that anymore.
But do you notice that we're doing the same thing now? They're so fascinating because it's
right,
instead of talking about the victims here, we are talking about, it's hard not to.
Yeah. I feel terrible now.
It happens to me all the time.
I'm glad you pointed that out because we need to turn around our thinking quite a lot. And it takes a lot of effort to do that, especially with the kind of media that we're exposed to. George?
Yeah. Hi, how are you?
Hi.
I think it's great that a project like this doesn't let victims die in vain. It's great that the spirits of those that have been victimized by terrorism lives on through the X-Ray Project. Has something like this, in general, helped people appreciate one another a little more? In other words, I think before 9/11, we lived life a certain way, and then after those terrorist attacks happened, everybody says that's when things changed. Do you think now through projects like this, people have learned to appreciate everyday things a little more, appreciate life a little more, and have more camaraderie with one another?
I don't know. I wish I could confidently say it was true. I have a personal anecdote that went the other way, which is my daughter was in New York and had an injured foot. And a pipe blew up in the street, and it looked like 9/11 to the people. The street blew up. There was smoke. There was a lot of hot water, and people started running in terror. This was a few summers ago, right around the center of Manhattan, Grand Central Station. And on 9/11, when people first saw the airplanes going to the buildings, many people ran towards the buildings to help. Do you remember this?
Yep.
They ran towards. This day, they all ran away. And, of course, they weren't needed, so it didn't matter. But it was kind of striking because the fear triggered the flight response, and they couldn't help it.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it's sad, too.
Well, I can remember, though, living in Israel with terrorist acts all the time. We were told, you know, if there's a bomb, then you should really go the other way. First of all, because in Israel, you know, it's established with, the medical workers coming on the scene and the emergency care people, you know, all the immediate care people coming to the scene and they're trained and we're not, so we should move out of the way. Also because, you know, a bomb, the way it's set up is that a bomb could go off, you know, the next minute,
just
wherever you're going to. So it's very well organized. And, this is a very well designed program, as you mentioned before. I wanted to know, when you first started the project, you first had the idea, I'm sure you were, I don't want to say less informed, but maybe more innocent to say. And as you developed the project and worked on it, you became much more knowledgeable and informed. But I'm wondering how your goals compared to the results that you were looking for when you just started to the results you're getting now. Are they in sync with what you had intended?
To a certain extent, I had three main goals. One was to change the conversation about terrorism.
Which I do hope you're doing, and you're doing it now.
To a certain extent, the conversation changes when people are in contact with the X-Ray Project because they do start to talk about the victims. Another was to change media coverage so that victims were taken into account and people were discussing the victims. And you can judge for yourself. I think I'm a drop in the bucket there. Thirdly, I was hoping to raise money for the hospitals. There were, because the two hospitals that provided the material were Shari Zedek and Hadassah Karam. And actually, the head of the ER department at Shari Zedek died in the period
Applebaum,
when
Dr. Applebaum with his daughter.
Right.
He was killed in a terror attack in the period when I was developing the project. I always wanted the installation to be exhibited with a fundraiser, and it happened a couple of times in a small way, but I always had these dreams that there would be these large fundraisers for these two hospitals. It didn't happen as much. What was most successful was the media. It was covered by La Repubblica in Italy, which is their biggest newspaper by far, put my project up on the website for 24 hours and covered it exclusively, you know, extensively for 24 hours. And it was covered in several large newspapers and television, you know, stations in the United States. And I think that I once calculated that over 2 million people had contact with the X-ray project. But I always wish that I could have changed the media dialogue more and raised more money that for the hospitals.
Bivracha, we hope that you will yet be able to do that. People can contact you again at www.x-rayproject.org. x-rayproject.org. And Diane Covert, we are really, really happy that you have been able to be with us today. So thank you, and we wish you the most and best success with this project.
Thank you so much for having me, and I had a lot of fun. That was great.
Thank you. So
our Torah portion this week is Vayakhel. This Shabbat preceding Passover is one of the special Shabbatot, and it's called Shabbat HaGadol. Passover is the living reminder of the need to follow God's ways of justice and righteousness in our lives as Jews, to bring the historic lesson of Passover to bear on our conduct to our fellow human beings, Jews and non-Jews alike, and our responsibility to promote freedom from bondage and freedom from want to the best of our personal ability, and as a guide principle in the life of our communities through the world and the state of Israel. Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom from Israel is Real, and we're WSMN 1590. Shabbat Shalom. Israel is Real.
Connecting you to the news of the day.
Because community.